Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's just a great pleasure to welcome back Richard Dolan to the Salieri Report. As you know, Richard is one of the leading researchers in the world and writers on the UFO topic. He's my go-to person for anything UFO and alien and related. But I also think he's the really one of the leading thinkers on how do we get to Western civilization? How do we get from here to there? What are the obstacles? What are the issues? And I said in the annual wrap-up, I think one of the reasons we're pushing for a global currency is we're watching a governance infrastructure that wants to set up a financial system that can work on multiple planets. And if you want to contemplate that, there's nobody better to listen to than Richard's work on the UFO topic, but on what some of the key issues are in the debate between centralization and decentralization. So if you haven't dipped into his website, Richard Dolan Press, at richarddolanpress.com, and the books he's publishing and the work he's doing, I strongly recommend it. I don't think you can understand reality these days without doing it. I have to say that in a sane world, we would be talking to Richard, who'd probably have a chair in history at Princeton University. So, but it's a different world, and so you have to build your own chair these days. We're going to be talking about what do we know about underground facilities. This is a topic that has tremendous economic impact. If you asked me how much of the U.S. GNP was underground, I'd probably say it's at least 5 or 10%, even more. This affects numerous industries: oil mining, offshore drilling, construction, defense. We're going to be talking about the financial ramifications. But a lot of this world is invisible, and Richard has done a great job, including publishing the leading author on underground facilities, and has done a great job in helping that work get out and about and summarizing it. So I'm really glad he could join us today. So Richard, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Good afternoon, Catherine. It's always a pleasure to be here talking with you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I dove in. I got back from the Secret Space Program where you and I both spoke, which was just a wonderful experience. And I came back realizing, you know, the percentage of the GNP in underground facilities is really bigger than I thought. So I got online and I said, okay.
5 to 10%. That blew my mind when I heard you say that.
Well, think about it. You know, when we get into financial implications, I'll explain why. But I think a lot of the most valuable weaponry is down there. So, yeah, I think it's pretty significant. Anyway, so I got back and I jumped online. Who's got the best video on underground facilities? And I wasn't surprised. It was Richard Dolan. So I'm really glad you could do this. Well, just, you know, dive in, Richard, because right. I know you know this topic.
Well, it's a fascinating topic. I'm not really the main person who's been researching underground bases of facilities for all these years. That distinction goes to my friend and colleague, and your colleague as well, and maybe your friend,
yes,
Souter, a PhD. And Richard, since the 1990s, has written a number of books and done studies on the probabilistic virtual certainty of a large clandestine network of underground bases and tunnel systems that, in his opinion, are probably global. A couple of years ago, he approached me if I would publish his, you know, what was then his latest work on the subject, which I agreed to do. It was actually the first book by another author that I ever published, and I've since gone on and I've published a number of other fascinating authors as part of Richard Dolan Press, but Richard Souter was the first one, and his book is called Hidden in Plain Sight. I published it last in April of 2010, I believe, 2010, so almost 5 years ago. This is a really, it's an excellent book. I think it's his best book on the subject. And as a result of publishing it, I went through every page. And I have to say, when I completed working with that book of his, that study, it's one of those short little gems of a book that when you're done with it, you feel like it's just transformed the way you look at the world. What he has argued is that there are many secret underground and probably undersea bases and tunnels around the world. He documents what looks like a number of them. These can be very large and surprisingly deep. They contain very sophisticated technology. His argument is that there are many thousands of people involved in building these bases and these systems, operating them and maintaining these facilities. They're global. They're all around. He does discuss things like other technologies, basically argues back in the 1950s and 60s that the plans were in place, in particular United States Navy had plans to go very, very deep under the ocean floor for their own permanent undersea bases. This sounds fantastical, but yet he discusses the plans there. He points out that the technology has existed for decades and generations to do this. A lot of the technologies that we have, these very, very high-powered underground boring machines, we've had these for quite some time, and they can do an amazingly effective job. And then there are a number of leaks that have come from the classified world that support this idea also that there are these large facilities. So basically, underneath our feet, there's this whole other world. I study UFOs, and we tend to look up at the stars and think, oh, I wonder if there's life out there. But what we really could do with some benefit to ourselves is look below our feet and ask ourselves, is there life down there, sophisticated technological life, and is it our own civilization? And is it possible that there are other groups down there as well? This is another line of speculation that he engages in, a lot of us have engaged in. Are there non-human beings, non-human civilizations under the ground as well? That's a whole other question. We can deal with some, whenever, but certainly there's a human infrastructure down there. And some of the other technologies for transport would include things like probably high-speed tube shuttle train systems probably exist. There's a lot of work on the technology to develop these. When we talk about maglev train systems, like China's really, out in the lead on those. The biggest problem with the maglev system is not the not the weight of the train and not getting the lift. It's actually wind resistance. And if you can create an underground tunnel system and create a partial vacuum, you can go incredibly fast under the ground with a maglev system that's in a partial vacuum. And in fact, what we now understand through Richard Souther's work and some other people is that, again, the plans on these have been looked at since the 1930s and 40s for these types of systems. Some of them very, very ingenious. Goes way, way, way back. Ultimately, when you look at the sum total of the reality of a massive underground system, it's clear that we are being lied to on such a massive scale. I mean, the scope of this is just mind-boggling. I've been looking into the UFO mystery for over 20 years now. I'm used to being lied to. But when you take a few steps back and you get a grand perspective of the magnitude of the lies, not simply with UFOs, but with underground bases and with financial fraud and with many of the other things going on in this world, 9/11, you start realizing, my God, it's orders of magnitude beyond what any normal, sane person should ever have to deal with in terms of being lied to.
Right.
But yeah, it's a massive reality. And his work, I really think that Hidden in Plain Sight is probably the best single book-length subject on this so far.
I have to tell you, after I left the Secret Space Program, I was with someone who'd been there, and we were driving down the highway in Los Angeles, and for the first time I could see a mural in my mind of both the overt and the covert economy, both underground, UFOs, space, and the cash flows, and how, I could literally paint a picture of how the overt and covert cash flows worked underground, on the ground, in the space, and I could see it and realize how people could drive down the highway and not see it. You've got this entire coexisting civilization and it's completely invisible. It's quite remarkable how it's been done, but it's here and it's operating, and we might as well, if you're going to understand reality, I think you just need to integrate that picture into your mind.
Well, you know, that's a really excellent point, Hazard, because I remember asking Richard some years ago, how would they hide the construction of these things? And he said, which is the title of his book, it is hidden in plain sight. You can hire construction companies from Bechtel onward. There's all of these that exist that would work with the national security complex. And, you know, there's all kinds of cover that they're doing other types of construction work. But hiding off the side of a highway where everyone's driving, you would think, no, that's not possible. They couldn't hide it there. They could, and they do.
Yeah.
They absolutely can hide it there. So, yeah, this goes on. And, you know, again, there's a in his book and also you can find on the web, there's archival research that is available that shows the documents and the plans to do this. I mean, right after World War II, the United States military, this was an interest of mine before I went off into the UFO research field when I was still as a formal graduate student. I remember spending some time looking at plans that the U.S. Army had to build underground bases after the Second World War. Back then, the idea was simply to protect against an atomic war. If the Russians got the bomb and they were to drop bombs on us, we would need underground facilities to, you know, have continuums of government and so forth. So those plans we know have existed. What we don't know a whole lot of is the full scope of what has been accomplished. But we certainly know that there are a lot of documents, a lot of plans to create underground facilities. You know, one thing that Richard Sauter did that I think helped him in his research is that he had a lot of research and knowledge done on mining and drilling technologies. This just was an important past interest in his life, aside from traveling and cultivating the sources and getting insider claims. But there's a tremendous amount of good research done in the open literature that, you know, indicates these plans. And by the way, as far as how far down can these people go, we're talking anywhere from many hundreds of feet to thousands of feet.
The open literature is miles.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Last summer, I did a tour of Canada, and I was at I was in the town of Sudbury, Ontario, which happens to be the site of, I think, possibly the deepest officially known scientific underground facility in the world. And that is a facility that is, it's a couple of miles below the ground, if I'm not mistaken. That facility exists in order to, what do they do there? It's basically they have to protect against X-rays and, you know, intense solar radiation, and you've got to go deep under the earth to do it. But yeah, that's official, and that's a couple of miles below. I think the deepest mine in the world right now is a little more than 2 miles, if I'm not mistaken. So it's looking at some data here, a little over 12,000 feet, about 2.5 miles. That's the deepest mine. So we're able to go pretty far down. But even if it's 1 mile, heck, you've got complete security. And think about, who would want an underground base? Well, honestly, everyone would want an underground base. If you're the CIA and running a clandestine prison, would you not want to have a deep underground base for total security, especially if you're on a, you know, little Pacific island in the middle of nowhere? You take someone there, they disappeared. They're completely off, you know, off the face of the earth.
Right.
One of the things that I think probably the most fascinating bit of Sauter's research that, you know, I think is particularly noteworthy is the idea of bases that are under the ocean floor. And, you know, when we first think about that, we think, well, that's got to be impossible. How could you have a base that is under the floor of the Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean? How could you breathe and so on? Well, first of all, we should keep in mind that we have already built substantial under substantial tunnels that go under large bodies of water. If you're in the New York City area and you go to the Lincoln Tunnel, the Holland Tunnel, boom, you got that. If you go from England to France, you take the Channel Tunnel, the Channel, that's over 20 miles under the ocean floor. Japan also has an equally long tunnel that's over 20 miles in length that people go under the ocean floor. We've got the technology. This is all out in the open and the ability to do it. One of the things that Souder uncovered were explicit U.S. Navy illustrations from the 1960s by a Navy artist and illustrator named Walter Kirshner, who is still alive, by the way. Souder had a number of interviews with Kirshner, who ended up giving him the illustrations he did for the Navy. They contracted with him in 1968 to draw illustrations of a proposed underwater facility that they were planning or possibly planning to build. And he did these, and it is just absolutely...
I love the one of the guys playing ping pong.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
yeah.
This is under the ocean floor. And right, there's one, they're playing ping pong and just having a nice kind of relaxing time. Because really all that you need ultimately is oxygen and a source of energy. And you basically can do this. And since the 1950s, we've had the ability to extract oxygen out of the water, hydrolysis. This is exactly what nuclear submarines use in order to stay under the water for months at a time. They're not using oxygen tanks, clearly. They're taking the oxygen out of the ocean floor. So, and then if you have a small source of energy, or whether it's geothermal energy or even a small nuclear reactor technology, which has existed obviously since the 50s, you really can do it. As long as you've got a geological location, you could create, carve out your underground base under the ocean floor, and you're in total secrecy.
But the source of energy has always been a great interest to me, because there's no way those guys could be running that much stuff on fossil fuels that far underneath the earth. So the question is, what are they using? And to the extent they're connected with UFOs, certainly they have something other than fossil fuels. So to me, that's one of the great mysteries. Yeah.
Well, nuclear power, even standard fission, would easily get the job done. Now,
yeah, that's true.
A fission reactor is a major undertaking, but what about a small fission reactor, something that doesn't need to, you know, take care of an entire region of a state, but maybe, you know, just one particular base? Perhaps it could be done on a manageable scale.
Well, you know, it's interesting. They didn't want thorium. You know, Rickover killed thorium in the 70s. But thorium would be a much safer way to go, and would work underground. So
but I wouldn't doubt it. But we have nuclear submarines, we have battleships or aircraft carriers rather that run on nuclear fuel, and those are massive cities on the water. They don't need to be refueled for decades at a time, and we've had that capability for many decades. So I would think that you could, if nothing else, you could use something along those lines to power these underground facilities if you wanted them totally off the grid. You know, I don't know. But Kirshner had a number of these illustrations. He was attached to the China Lake facility. This is during the 1960s, and that was at that time that the Navy was developing detailed plans to create large technological complex, deeply buried manned bases beneath the seafloors in mid-ocean. And his job in 1968 was to illustrate the Navy's plan. So he did one that was a depiction. It's a good one off of Santa Catalina Island, right off the coast of Southern California. Nice illustration that basically gives kind of a cutout of, you know, below the water, how this would be constructed in the ground. He's got illustrations of divers and then like openings into the ground, and occasionally like glass bubbles in the water. It almost has a little bit of a Jetsons look to it. You know, it's like 1960s.
It really does, yeah.
Yeah, kind of optimistic, sort of futuristic technology there. But what's key about it is when he, you know, does the plans for the geology under the ocean floor, you know, cutting away certain parts of under ocean mountains to create bases and this type of thing. This is like a really big part of his illustration, so it's obvious that this is what the Navy was planning to do. And what we don't have are confirmation from the Navy as to whether these went into place. This is decades ago, but and I remember asking Richard Sauter, did Kirshner know? Sauter asked Kirshner, do you know if they built these bases? And Kirshner said, hey, look, my job was just to draw the pictures. I'm in building these things. So Kirshner doesn't really claim to have any knowledge either.
But see, if you look at how much money's disappearing, Richard, during this period, I can't come up with too many other ways. If you look at how much money's disappearing, it has to be justified by something. You know, it just says to me that I bet they've poured a lot of money underground. I just can't fathom, unless we're paying a dividend off planet.
Well,
right.
In terms of the amount of money needed, I want to deal with this, because in fact, yes, these are expensive, but they were not, even for the time, they were not outrageously expensive. There's a study from 1968 called The Feasibility of Manned In-Bottom Bases. This is from Stanford Research Institute. It's in California. 1968 paper, and they state here the construction of 30 manned in-bottom bases within the ocean floor, they say, is technically and economically feasible. Their estimate was that it might take 15 years to get this whole thing underway. But they state the major technology for a land link station in bottom is established now. Only adaptations are needed. Their estimate of the cost to 30 undersea bases was $2.7 billion. That's 1968.
Right.
That's a lot of money,
right.
Even 1968, but it's not a sum that would be impossible.
No, here's what does get expensive, though, is maintenance. So if you look at how much it costs to build them and then you look at how much it costs to maintain them every year, you're locking in a significant overhead. And that's, you know, the overhead grows and grows and grows. Right. And that's where I think it all gets very, from a financial standpoint, it gets interesting.
I think it's a very good point. Yeah, I'm sure. No question. I had a conversation some years ago with a well-placed scientist, very well-placed scientist, and I think you'll want to hear this, who... This man confirmed to me on multiple occasions the existence of deeply clandestine programs to study and attempt to replicate alien technology. I've had long conversations with him. He's rather famous, and one day I'll put his name out there. But we were talking about the creation of an expensive infrastructure and basically what the secrecy entailed. And he put out to me his belief, maybe knowledge, I don't know, that the cost of security and maintaining all the secrecy on this program was 7 to 8 times that of the actual scientific R&D.
Absolutely.
By security, right, he had to be talking underground infrastructures, I'm assuming, as well as like guys with guns, and as well as management of the media, all of the things involved in maintaining security over the program. But vastly more expensive than the actual science involved.
I really believe that one of the primary goals of the legal infrastructure they put in place after 9/11 was to significantly reduce the cost of capital and the difficulty of financing and the cost of, you know, the just basic costs of keeping it secret, mm-hmm. all of this world. You know, it had reached an unbearable level, and you literally had to change the laws related to government transparency and financing and all sorts of other stuff to make it possible to keep it secret at a feasible cost.
I want to make sure I'm understanding you. This sounds like a really important point. So, in other words, it's cheaper now for those individuals to maintain the secret.
Put it this way: for a thousand. First of all, let's say pre 9/11, you were spending $1,000. For every $1,000 you spent on black budget operations, including underground, you know, let's say your cost of 9/11 cut your cost of capital in half, and it lowered, you know, now instead of spending $1,000, you could spend $800. Okay. And really it was because of, one, you could do a lot more on budget than, you know, this crazy dysfunctional sort of fraud off budget. Two, you had stolen enough money, so you had a permanent endowment that you didn't have to explain to anybody. But also you had the laws in place, you know, I used to call the Patriot Act the Control and Concentration of Cash Flow Act of 2001. But you had the controls in place, so a lot of what you were spending to keep things secret, you know, you didn't have to spend. You could make it cheaper. So you lower your expenses, you lower your cost of capital, and you make the whole thing much more manageable because you couldn't increase the size of it. You know, it kept growing and growing and growing, and you couldn't grow it anymore without just unbelievable. You know, you're just going to have to kill way too many people to keep it silent.
Right. I do understand. Yeah. I hadn't really thought about it in your way in terms of the finance, but this makes perfect sense. Makes absolutely perfect sense. This is why your work is so important. I had seen 9/11 as a kind of, almost like the debutante's coming out party. We've had the development of this national security empire that has been happening for decades, but a lot of it was still technically illegal. All the government spying and the sort of development of this national security state out of the corpse of a republic, like in the movie Alien, the thing comes out of the guy's
mouth. Right.
But it was all sort of like unofficial still. We still, officially speaking, had this system of rule of law. And what 9/11 did, it was like essentially a coming out. It's like, oh, no, now we have a new system of government. And really it did, I think, simplify a lot of the legalities of the illegal. It made legal the illegalities, and it made above board.
Here's the problem you've got. When you're running huge numbers of illegal operations, and you're depending on, let's say you're depending on a leadership of 1,000 people, when they start to fight, they start to throw criminal liability to each other, and then the thing explodes. So, for example, a perfect example was when Hank Paulson, who didn't know he couldn't let AIG go down, threatened to let AIG go down, 1,000 leaders realized that they were suddenly going to have their files that prove criminal liability against them everywhere. You know, and they just said no way, you know. Right. So
that's why AIG was too big to fail.
It was too big to fail because it had you had a what was the equivalent of a government and shadow government bureaucracy. It was manning the risk liabilities on 50 years of black budget operations and financing. You know, to this day, I believe it was AIG that traded the government and currency markets to basically self-finance 9/11. So there's no way.
Had to be preserved, not to preserve the economy, but to preserve those individuals from going to prison.
No, it was bigger than that, because if you let AIG go down and let those files go to the highest bidder, you were talking about flipping the entire investment model on the whole planet Earth. In other words, the central banking warfare model could not tolerate that disclosure. So you would have needed to have a new economic model in place, but literally.
Maintain that secret is what you're saying. It's not simply for economic salvation. It is to maintain the secrecy of this operation. Yeah.
So let me just take you on a tangent for a second. The New York Times just published an article by Gretchen Morgenson, who's been following the mortgage debacle. And a shareholder of Freddie and Fannie filed a lawsuit demanding documentation on the government's takeover in Freddie and Fannie. And here we are in 2015. The government is taking the position in court that disclosure of that documentation would crash the financial system. And Morgenson is saying, That's absurd. You know, this is 2015. We're talking about something that happened in 2008. You know, the markets have moved on. This can't possibly hurt the markets. I agree with the government. You know, if people understood that, that Fannie, Freddie, the Department of Justice, the Department of Treasury were going along for years issuing 10 mortgages on one house, there would be a problem. Terrible. So, yeah, so
many of these dark secrets that go back decades, that's why they still have to lie about the Kennedy assassination.
Right. So
people who killed Kennedy are still fundamentally in power today.
Right. So well, of course, to the victor go the spoils, right?
Yes.
So,
yes.
So, you know, here's, we're talking, this comes down to the line between, you know, the real world and Disney World. And anything that tears that fabric down is a really sensitive point. I just, before you go on, I just have to bring up one thing. When I was on, you have a wonderful section in your presentation that you have up online about the Denver airport. And when I was on Wall Street, there used to be scandal after scandal in the firms that were financing the Denver airport. And it got to the point where, you know, I never paid any attention to it. It was rare because I was known for infrastructure financing, but I had nothing to do with that one. And it just, the stories became so bizarre as to the overruns that you said, I don't know what's going on there, but whatever's going on there is really dangerous and bizarre. So, you know, it's just funny because right. Even then, back then, we knew something was terribly, terribly wrong. It's those Orwellian situations. But anyway, so.
No, the Denver airport is, it's one of those things that everyone who's looked into this a little bit is very suspicious of and fascinated by. We've both been to the Denver airport, and you walk around, and there's some very bizarre murals, incidentally, in that.
The murals are just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
You can't believe that a municipal official approved that. Right.
Yeah, it's horrific, apocalyptic scenes of, like, futuristic death and, you know, armies in black uniforms basically just controlling, mowing down innocent people and causing death and mayhem. I mean, who the hell comes up with these ideas? It's insane. And then, of course, the demonic horse in front of the airport with the glowing red eyes and, like, what is this place? Where am I going into the Mount of Sauron, the gates of hell? In terms of Souder's work on it, I remember asking him about it. He's, you know, he feels that's a major, it's important there, but I remember he spent more time talking about some of the other nearby places. There's a Denver Federal Center, which is the location of a FEMA underground command center, which he feels is more important than a Denver airport. He didn't really write a lot about the Denver airport and hidden in plain sight, but I remember I personally spoke to a number of people in the Denver area who seemed to have real knowledge of this. Famously, you know, construction on that airport was delayed for like a year. They were talking about conveyor belt issues, and people were like, really? Conveyor belt issues is causing this delay for an entire year? It seemed like a very lame excuse, and indeed there are, you know, I'm not aware of these being confirmed, but there are constant rumors of a massive kind of like second seat of government base underneath that airport.
Right.
I'd be surprised if there weren't something major there. But that whole region, the Colorado, you've got Cheyenne Mountain, of course, major, many years underground command center for NORAD. And, you know, you go out to the southwest, you've got massive underground bases that over at Kirtland and Manzano facility in New Mexico.
Right.
And that's since the 1940s. The amount, Richard spoke to a miner who excavated the Manzano base. A lot of these miners were blindfolded when they were transported to and from the work site in very compartmented assignments. So no one knew the layout as a result of that. Just, and then, you know, the whole Los Alamos and White Sands complex out there, massive underground sprawling facilities going as much as a mile deep. major underground component over at White Sands, what these things are being used for. There is one account he got from an ex-Navy guy from over at White Sands who knew a water well contractor who was hired to do work there. The guy was hired to drill 10 or 12 inch holes down to like 800 or 1,000 feet, and he thought, all right, no big deal. While he was drilling, his big bit broke through many times, and cold air would rush up through the hole, and his boss has said, don't worry about it. So there were air shafts down there. He, probably was reaching a major facility down there that needed air shafts, and it wasn't his business to know. And, of course, you got the massive facilities over in Nevada, Area 51, Tonopah, Nevada Test Site, S4, Nellis Air Force Base. That whole area, which is, I think, larger than the nation of Switzerland, if my memory serves correctly, is replete with massive underground facilities. China Lake, California, same thing. These are probably bases that go a mile deep or even more.
I used to have, many years ago, I used to have a subscriber who knew the Bush family and insisted that Zapata was not an offshore drilling company for oil. It was drilling for missile silos as a proprietary for the CIA, which, you know, wouldn't surprise me, because I think there's a, between the mining industry and the offshore drilling, I think there's a lot of, there's a lot of crossover. And, right. So I really started to watch the earnings of these different companies and try and compute, okay, how much of this is covert versus overt. And I noticed in the 90s, a lot of the big offshore drilling companies suddenly pulled up stakes and moved to Switzerland or, you know, Bermuda, or completely reconfigured their whole. Halliburton moved to, it spun off KBR and moved to Dubai. So you had this flood of companies moving offshore, and you wondered how much of it was to protect their national security operations.
Yeah, and this is the thing. I mean, so much of this has, you know, gone out of the country. It's international. We're in a completely We don't have an era of nations anymore. You as much as anyone else, have talked about this. Really, we've experienced the death of nations, and as well as the death of the rule of law. But these organizations go where they want. You know,
right.
When I was a kid, I remembered I was taught, like, as I'm sure you were, in very kind of a nationalistic, American-centered sort of history. That world is gone. That's long gone. That
right.
Doesn't exist anymore. And these guys can exist. They can do their operations anywhere in the world. And that goes for these underground bases. That goes for what I have often called a breakaway civilization, with weaponry that is off the charts, technology that's off the charts. Incidentally, I'm reminded of a conversation Sauter had with a Navy engineer who had worked at China Lake. He was talking about a huge underground facility there, and Sauter said, well, what's down there? And the guy just says, weapons. And Sauter says, well, what kind of weapons? And all he would say is, weapons more powerful than nuclear weapons. Whatever that
they means. You found the earthquake machine.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Something like that. So there's the technology. I mean, the question is where is the money coming from to fund all of this? And obviously we're talking about beyond simply formal classified tax dollars in the form of the official black budget, which according to, I think, Wired magazine is like a little over, $50 billion. Really? Wired
right.
magazine? Are you serious? First of
right.
all, the official black budget number from 1990, as reported by Tim Weiner, back then, was over $30 billion, and that was with a defense budget of about $300 billion at the time, roughly speaking. We're
right.
almost three times that amount now, and we're supposed to believe that the black budget is only $50 billion. Seriously doubt that.
Well, remember the
securities fraud money, narco money, you know, all of the black hole at the center of our global financial system.
Right.
Flows.
Well, my theory, we required in the first Bush administration audited financial statements, and a process started in 1995 whereby they said, we can't comply. And in fact, it was the 9/11 was the given as the excuse why they couldn't, because the, you know, you blew up one of the financial offices at the Pentagon. And but anyway, if you look at the numbers, my theory on all of this, because you were, if you look at where the offshore or the underground bases are said to be, at least in North America, it's very contiguous to the patterns of big mortgage and other place-based fraud. So drug dealing levered by mortgage fraud. And there's enormous geographical alignment between the between the sources and the needs. But I think if you look at what happened in the 90s, that you had a very strategic effort to say, look, we can't keep going this way. We need to create an endowment of funds that can literally produce, you know, an ongoing funding of this operation on a private basis. So think of this as privatizing the federal finances, or at least a portion of it.
Yeah.
So I think one part of this, you know, because they didn't clean up all the financial fraud. You know, all the money during the bailouts wasn't used to pay off all the fraud, from what I can tell. So that money went somewhere. And if you look at the squabbles in G7 between the government leaders saying they're going to go after the offshore monies, I think that's more than just the 40, or I forget what the number is of how much is offshore. But if you look at what's said overtly to be in offshore havens, I think when they talk about offshore, they're talking about a much bigger pile of money. So I think this yeah. I think the breakaways now have private funding lined up and own probably a significant portion of the world's corporate infrastructure.
Has to be. Well, here's a thought that I've been kicking around for the past year or so in terms of the breakaway civilization. Isn't it accurate to say that what we're seeing right now is a breakaway financial civilization in terms of the construction of basically transnational legal entities? One example is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which WikiLeaks has been talking about and other people are talking about, and the creation of all of which are created by a very small number of leading corporate entities, and that are allowing them literally to break away from traditional national control. My guess is that we're seeing the construction, the creation of basically a new royalty, the new lords, the new serfs, that's us, who will no longer need really to have any kind of connection to traditional national ideas of national sovereignty. And I think that this is probably as a way to kind of consolidate control by the actual breakaway civilization. I think that you're right.
That's right.
They are involved in the financial control, and they're basically they're completely breaking away from the world. But this will allow them, once their control is complete, what I actually think, I think there's an end game in mind here, the more I think about this. And I think that, I mean, one of the things that's happening is, it's like in the movie Highlander, where they used to say there can only be one. You remember that movie with the guys with the swords and they were immortal?
Yeah.
You get their head cut off and then they would lose their power and it would go to the guy who killed them. I think that we're actually in that. In other words, for the first time in human history, we have the ability for a very small number of people to own basically everything. The water, the genetically modified foods, the minerals. This hasn't really been the case in centuries past. I mean, to own everything on the planet. And I think what we're seeing is a consolidation of power blocks. So primarily that the power block that controls the U.S. and the EU and NATO and all of that. But you have another power block that still is substantial, and that's Russia, and now it looks like China. This is my take on it. They have a very, you know, close relationship in many ways, and that's kind of related to the BRICS group, but I think it's really Russia and China that are running that.
Right.
And I think that the Wall Street and White House nexus is trying to destroy Russia right now, and maybe break China, and you know, however they can, but they want to take Russia out of the game. And somehow this is related to what's happening in terms of, I'm trying to see how this relates to the breakaway.
So it relates to who's in control of the global currency. That's what it relates to.
Yeah, exactly.
And
exactly.
Right. And
got the petrodollar, I assume.
Part of the challenge is, how do you replace the Bretton Woods system? What do you replace it with? But also, how do you create the financial infrastructure to go to a multi-planet society? And I agree with you. I think that there can only be one. And the question is, how does that all get sorted out? And I agree. I think they want to break Russia because they want to make sure Germany and Europe is tied into them and not to, you know, the BRICS and the Eurasian group. Let me bring up, I want to go back in history for a second before we come up to the past and bring up some of the related topics that I thought about when I was watching your incredible presentation. One is, I went back about 6 months ago and listened to Annie Jacobs' book. I listened to it on audio on Operation Paperclip. And it's, I would say that it was a lot of detail on Operation Paperclip that I hadn't heard. I don't necessarily agree with her framework or assessment, but a lot of detailed information. And I heard a lot about the Nazi Germany underground bases in manufacturing and the labor policies they used, you know, how they ran it with slave labor.
Right.
And it sounded remarkably, you know, I thought, oh my God, you know, some of this came out of Paperclip. It came out of the Nazis we brought over because we got all their technology. And we made a real effort to suck up their underground technology. And I thought, okay, now I see where this got going. But the other reason, because Jacob went into a lot of detail about their labor policies, at the time I was interviewing Zach Taylor on the extraordinary flood of immigration across, he's a head of the National Association of Former Border Patrol Agents. And he and the Border Patrol guys are saying that the immigration is much greater than is being described in the press or by the government. And, of course, the big question is, where are all these people going? And one of the questions I have is, how many of them are disappearing, you know, down into the underground bases? Underground bases need cleaning ladies, too.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, so...
I think,
you know,
it's actually reasonable. By the way, her book is, I mean, it got panned for her whole Roswell thesis, which I think was completely wrong. But there is a lot of good information in there, as you're pointing out, at the paper clip connection.
Right.
Certainly is important. And the fact that, basically, you know, she's just another argument that shows that after World War II, the United States swallowed the Nazi pill. I mean, we just took it.
Right.
And created a lot of our post-World War II infrastructure based on the Nazi model. And that includes where they pioneered the construction of sophisticated underground facilities during the Second World War. They really had some of the best people in the world. We brought them over. Dornberger, who is the supervisor of Wernher von Braun, was himself a genius and was one of the key people involved in helping to, you know, formulate, I think, underground bases here in the United States after the war. What Walter Dornberger was his name.
Right. One of the reasons I was so interested is, of course, you know, when I see the UFOs, the question is, well, who's manufacturing it? And the Germans were very good at manufacturing underground and keeping the manufacturing secret as a result of that. So I just think that, you know, if you go back and you look at what the Germans were doing, and the thing that's chilling, of course, is that whole group absolutely believed in slave labor. And that's how they made a lot of this go. And so,
well, the United States had a nice long history of endorsing slave labor. We called it slavery.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, it actually made a lot of economic sense to those white plantation owners back in those days. They thought, yeah, that's the best way to do it. It wasn't that long before that, you know.
Well, but if you look at in the 90s, we had an unprecedented. I mean, I don't know if you've ever read my online book, but we had an unprecedented explosion in prison population. And that's another question I have, is any of that population disappearing down, you know, into these bases? It's a scary thing to contemplate, but I think it's a question that needs to be asked.
Being medically experimented on, all kinds of possibilities here in our increasingly privatized system. There's some slavery for you, by the way.
Right.
Color-coded, as we had 150 years ago.
Right.
Basically, giving these people, I don't know, a dollar a day to make clothing for Target or whatever they're doing in the prison system.
Right.
So it can say,
right.
It can say made in the USA. That's how we compete with Chinese slave labor. And
right.
American slaves.
Right. Although if you look at the economics of government money, it doesn't compete. I mean, it's the government spending $154,000 per person so that Target can pay a dollar an hour. So it's not cheaper. It's the,
right.
the
very good.
Yeah. Right. The government money is fantastic.
Yeah.
But I think there's, you know, whether it's with prison populations or the immigration population, there's some kind of dovetail that I don't understand, but I think is worth thinking about. A second thing I wanted to ask you about was if you look at the areas where the underground bases are, there are also areas that are having more and more problems with drought. And I almost wonder if there's a connection between the water use by the underground bases and the droughts or the dropping water tables.
That is fascinating. Now, there are a number of underground base facilities in the eastern U.S. where I'm not aware of
right.
drought, a lot in Virginia and during the, in the Washington.
All of Washington is an underground base and doesn't know it.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Right.
But, you know, we've all heard about the NSA data collection center in Utah. That's billions of dollars. That's got every single email that's ever been created probably in the history of the Internet. And they use massive amounts of water. Huge amounts of water, all from the state of Utah. And in fact, there's a citizen movement there to cut off that water. I'm sure they'll get nowhere because we don't, you know, we live in basically a global totalitarian system now. But I've got to think there's a tremendous amount of water that's being used there in these other underground systems.
Right.
All unofficial, but they exist. Great question. They have to be using an enormous amount of water. Some of them.
Yeah, that's what I would think. And that dovetails also with what they're doing, you know, especially if they're using nuclear.
Yeah, for sure.
Place.
And, who knows? Right, exactly. And or for NASA computers, the NSA Center in Utah, which is, I mean, officially does exist, uses that to cool their computers. And it's an enormous amount of water that they go through every day.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay, place-based amnesia. Let me explain what I mean by this. One of my struggles as I've always been interested in building the community economy, you know, sort of thinking of the community as a molecule of the body. And if the local economy isn't healthy, then, you know, individuals can't be healthy, and then the state economy can't be healthy, and then the national economy, you know. So I've always liked to think about building wealth bottom up, you know, sort of one person or one household or one community at a time. And I always had a problem on Wall Street and Washington because everybody thought, and, you know, it needed to be done by tomorrow and it needed to be at least $1 billion. And, you know, I thought, well, wait a minute, we got to unpack this. And anytime I tried to look at the economy by place, there was you'd run into this political force field. And what I discovered working in Washington and then serving as a financial advisor for a government agency is the people who run the world look at everything by place. And what they do is they do everything they can to get everyone else not to look at place because that busts their control. If you have the sources and uses of government spending by your congressional district, then you can really hold your congressman accountable. And so control requires people being sort of dumbed down about places. And until Google Maps came out, there was, you know, it was almost as though people were getting dumber and dumber. And literally, Richard, I can drive into a town on Route 64, stop at a diner, and ask the waitress where Route 64 is, and she won't know. It's scary.
Okay. Yeah.
And so there's kind of a dumbing down going on, and
right.
If you look at what's happening with the internet technology, you would think at some point it's going to reverse it. But you know, when I drive around and look for the signs of underground facilities, I can see them, and I can see some of the possibilities of how they might be financed, because these guys always like to get as much out of a place as they put back in. So there's always sort of an interaction with the local share. But there's something about our mentality as a people that we have become, I don't know if it's mind control or programming or what it is, but we have become, we don't see this. If you ask somebody where the Navy and Army bases are in their state, they won't know. So I'm curious if you're running into the place-based amnesia as you do this.
Well, I see what you're seeing around me, if that's what you're asking. I certainly think that we're in a it's kind of like this unstated revolution has happened. It's an unofficial revolution. All of the old forms exist, so there's still television, there's still TV news, but by degrees it's just gotten more and more mindless and more of a distraction, to the point where it's
right.
just a virtual mind control system. So we still officially have news articles, we still have newspapers, but behind those newspapers has been a consolidation of corporate ownership, so that you have very few companies that own everything, and all of that is hidden behind these veils. And at the same time, we still have schools, but increasingly the schools are not what schools used to be in earlier times.
Right.
We teach kids to read and we teach. So all of the institutions formally are there, but behind that has been fundamental changes. And that has absolutely resulted in a massive dumbing down of our population. I really think that, I mean, think about, what was the news article I was just seeing recently? Well, all of like the video cameras and things like that. You know, we've become inured to the fact that we're surveilled 24/7. If those video
right.
cameras that are on every single street corner, practically of every major city in this country, had been put up 30 years ago, people would have gone insane about that. They would never have
right.
allowed it. Never.
Right.
And yet we've gotten beaten over the head with a national security stupid stick for all of these decades.
I love that, the national security stupid stick.
I make this up as I go. So we walk around ducking our head and just accepting it. That's why I believe we live in an era, incidentally, of false flags. I'm convinced that this is the new kind of the doorway to an era, new era. We're in an era of false flags, and the reason, I think, is this is, I don't want to get too off topic here, but it has to be done from the point of view of those people who are transforming the world, because they need to corral the population into accepting increasingly draconian measures to control them, because this is necessary from their point of view in order to create the kind of global system that they need to create. They need to create a global totalitarian system from their point of view. And in fact, this can tie into a breakaway civilization. I've been thinking about this lately.
The breakaway civilization is steadily taking over more and more and more and more of the flow.
Yeah, they are. There's two races going on right now, as I see it. So one race is between breakaway civilization / control group at the top and the people. It's like a foot race. And the race is, will we be able to break their power by communicating and organizing and exposing their criminality before they consolidate their hold over a kind of global totalitarian system in which it might be impossible for us to break? That's one race. The other race is the breakaway civilization against these other beings that are here. And I want to explain this. So, there is a, I think, very overwhelming evidence from my research showing that there is the presence of an other that is here on planet Earth. All these flying saucers, UFOs, people are seeing, they're not all human manufactured. Some probably are. You and I are both very good friends with Joseph Farrell. He's made some very good arguments along these lines. I think that's right. We've got our own homemade flying saucers. I do not believe for an instant that all of them, or even the core of them, are made by us. If there is a breakaway civilization that exists, I guarantee you they are looking at those other beings from a military point of view and saying, we are way behind these guys and we've got to catch up desperately or we're potentially screwed. So how do you do that? You're talking about a massive covert R&D and manufacturing program that cannot be done under the public eye with public scrutiny from their point of view, because that's unacceptable. That would cause too much panic and it would give the game away. So they do it covertly. The only way to do it covertly is by subverting every constitutional law that you can imagine. They have to go around all of that. And also, I believe that their take on it is the only way we're going to catch up is by reorganizing human society. This democracy ruled by the people, that's old-fashioned, that can't work. We have to create a truly global totalitarian system, and I think that's exactly what they're moving for.
Well, I think it can work, but you got to clue everybody in on what's really going on.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I'm trying to look at it from their point of view, and I think this is what they've concluded. So all of this ties in. I think there's going to be an ultimate end game, incidentally, where they probably, what we call a breakaway civilization, I think what they're really moving toward is a true version of Hitler's master race. Think about the world that they're going to be able to create within 50 years. Not simply strong artificial intelligence, not simply quantum computing, which may already exist at NSA for all we know, not simply complete mastery of the human genome, not simply 3D printing, which will probably be organic 3D printing, not simply a panoply of massive sophisticated implants within the human being to give them superpowers, which in fact part of the military is already using now. I've talked with a number of these military people. Things that they can do with implants is amazing. But so, and not simply because of their mastery of the human genome to be able to cut off the aging process or at least substantially reduce it, to give super intelligence, super strength. Think about this. They are right on the cusp of creating virtual immortality, super strength, super intelligence for human beings. I'm pretty sure they're not going to want to give it to all of us. So it'll be for a very few people who can afford this. That'll be them. And they will literally create themselves as a kind of master superhuman race. On top of that, with control over a system that once the masses are under control of a kind of a virtual 24/7 complete mind control propaganda-induced reality, which we're not quite there yet, but we're getting there. Once I think they're sufficiently confident that they've got this completely under their control, I wouldn't be surprised then if they decide, yeah, we'll let the people know a little bit about this and that and the other, because there's really nothing that they'll be able to do about it. They'll be they won't need to do false flags as much.
Right.
Because it'll be a complete control system. Right now, they have to do false flags. They have to feign terrorist attacks, not simply 9/11 or anthrax. That's old school. The constant scaremongering that goes on in conjunction with mainstream media to frighten people into giving up more and more of their rights and to give up for more and more centralized control. I believe that as I said, I think we're in an era of almost continuous false flags until we get to a point of a true global totalitarian system, and then they'll probably switch tactics and move on to something else.
I don't know if you've noticed, but several of the most popular, widest circulation magazines have had cover stories about how we can all live to 123.
Yeah, Time. It was a Time or Newsweek.
Had an airplane. Time had one. Yeah.
140 something, possibly. Who knows? Well, that capability, they really understand it more and more. It also has to do with the telomeres in your DNA. They know how to prevent them now from degrading, apparently. It's only a matter of time before they're going to figure this out. I don't think anyone doubts this at this point. And then the real question philosophically as a species is, what do we do then? Does everything, even if you allowed people to live, I mean, what if we could live 120, 130, 140 years? Would we do that at a certain cost? Would we be therefore indebted to the new corporate fascist system and have to work at some, you know, menial slave job until we're 100 years old or 120 years old? I mean, really, what would we do? This is a whole other series of questions, but what would we do with such a long life?
Right. Well, the other problem is if you if you look to technology to make you longer lived or more powerful, as opposed to accessing the powers that humans have, you know, that have been dumbed out, it's kind of going in the wrong way to me. So I just think we use a very small portion of our intelligence, and what we have the capability of doing individually and collectively with natural methods is extraordinary. And there's been an extraordinary effort to keep us from doing that. So I kind of think it's taken us in the wrong direction. Can I pull you back to the money for a second? There are a couple of financial points I want to bring up that are a little bit more mundane, but are you aware of the national security waiver that allows the president to, or the national security advisor to waive a company's obligations to comply with SEC and other national rules about securities and financial disclosure?
No, but that sounds very ominous and really bad.
Well, that happened during the Bush administration. You know, they passed all these laws as a response to, you know, different various problems. And as they did, these companies that are doing, I think, a lot of the underground stuff or all the different things you've been talking about, you know, couldn't reconcile complying with financial disclosure laws and reporting all these earnings and engaging in these activities. So
have to report it.
Right. And it's funny. I constantly have heated debates back and forth with the financial community because they say corporate earnings can't possibly continue the way they are, but they're not looking at the full scope of corporate earnings. In a funny kind of way, you have a better handle on the fundamentals of corporate earnings than most financial advisors, I think.
Well, that's a frightening thought to me. I haven't had it, we're in real trouble. I would say this along the same line. This is directly analogous. When we talk about whether it's taxing, you know, like right now the Obama administration wants to tax the top 1% of wealth earners or income earners. Let me just say this. If someone's making $10 million, I don't really care. They want to have a nicer pool than I have. They want to have a nicer house than I have. They want a better car. Fine. Let them. There's nothing wrong, in my opinion, with a capitalist system that rewards, financially rewards people in aspects of our economy that are valued. I'm perfectly cool with that. It's someone who's making $10 billion a year or is worth, you know, $100 billion or more. These are the people who control governments. These are the people who can game the system.
Right.
That $5, $10 million, they're nothing. And yet these are the individuals that seem to be the real target of the current administration's, you know, actions. Oh, well, yeah, you're $5 million. We can take half of your money away or more than half of your money away. Well, you know what? I would say screw that. I think what we really so in other words, they're not looking at the actual culprit. And then think about environmental damage. We hear lots about climate change and the problems and that from driving your car. So you're contributing to global warming or what have you. I hear no one talking about the more than 2,000 high-altitude nuclear blasts that have taken place in this planet from the end of World War II to the end of the century, what environmental damage that's done. No one talks about that. I hear nothing about the ruinous effects of geoengineering, which is all but out in the open now and I think has been acknowledged. And there are particulates in those trails that are nasty and are doing serious environmental damage. I hear nothing about that. In other words, what we see across the board, whether it's financially, environmentally, or in any other way, is we're looking at the wrong culprits, and we're really just trying to blame, it's really blaming the little guy.
Right.
For problems that are being done by those very few individuals at the very tippy top of the power structure. No one looks at them. And it doesn't matter where you look.
Well, I wouldn't say no one. You're here. I'm here.
All right.
We're looking at him. But the message I want to keep bringing back to everybody is they are very expensive. These operations, whether it's the geoengineering or the underground bases or the spaceships or the black budget, that is the financial drain that has been harvesting the whole planet and harvesting our budget. And to me, the reason you got to look at it is, you know, you cannot back the drug dealers out of your neighborhood because they are financing Tony Soprano, who's financing James Bond, you know, who's financing Area 51. So, you know, so this is on a cash flow basis. This is this is the problem that you are having financially. You are paying for an extraordinary infrastructure that is very expensive and increasingly wealthy, and the wealthier it gets, the more it harvests you financially. And this is it.
True.
Right.
The money
so,
has disappeared, as you and other analysts have said, that there's a big financial black, there's a big black hole at the center of the global financial system. Trillions of dollars is just, apparently, what have they disappeared? Do they just go away?
Well, here's the funny thing. If you said, okay, you know something, we're going to bring transparency, but we're going to bring transparency in a way that creates more wealth for our civilization to make sure that we have planetary sovereignty, because I think that's part of what these guys are trying to buy. They're trying to buy planetary sovereignty, and they're trying to be a two-planet, if we're lucky, and a multiple, to be a two-planet system. So you say, okay, let's, and the guys, if you want depopulation, the guys who die are the ones who, who can't take the shock. So I vote for, I'm with Winston Churchill, I vote for transparency because I don't think whatever they're trying to accomplish, I don't think you can do it on a non-transparent basis. I mean, you have to have secrecy. But whatever you're doing, this is so unnatural, so unhealthy, so perverted, half the population that's left would rather, death is not the worst thing that can happen.
Yeah, they're creating a world of comprehensive web-like structure of lies that,
right,
that exists no matter where you look. And no, I mean, that's not a way for a dignified human civilization to exist. If we're lucky, they are trying to preserve our planetary sovereignty, as you put it. That's a possibility I've wondered about. The other possibility is that they're acting like, any other third world dictator who's into the pay of American or
right.
power, selling out
right.
the population and getting a piece of the action.
Right.
Like what's happening.
That's a possibility, too.
Where else right now.
Right.
Looking at human behavior over the years, I think that's at least as possible as the more noble goal of preserving our sovereignty. I don't really know.
Right. Whichever it is, we're on our own.
I remember a little journey that I've had a little over 20 years ago when I started researching UFOs. My mind was in a much more constricted area. I was just looking at that one phenomenon, and I thought, if I wrote a book that was good enough to crack that wall of secrecy, wow, wouldn't that be a great thing to do? And that's what I set out to do. Of course, well, it hasn't really quite happened. We haven't really opened up the wall of secrecy. But now when I look at the monumental web of secrecy and lies that envelop our daily lives, it's just an astonishing thing to me. My
brain
was not in this place 20 years ago. And going through this journey, it's clear to me that the secrecy and the deception goes, it's so ingrained. It's like Monsanto Roundup that's embedded in the very plants, the GMO plants that we're eating. That's the lies themselves are embedded in our very being. It's the exact
right.
same type of a, they create these genetically modified plants so that they're able to absorb the toxic Roundup and not die, and they kill off the insects. So genetically modified plant, you're eating Roundup.
I have two messages out of all of this, though, Richard, and that is, first of all, economically, if you look at how the finances work, there's no reason not for this planet to have abundant wealth. Whatever our problems are, they're political. They're not economic. So that's number one. But number two is, what I know is if you look at who these guys are and where they're headed, there is something worse than death. And I, for one, don't plan on being a citizen, a happy citizen in a, you know, in a totalitarian state. And so, you know, there is a tremendous advantage of, to me, of understanding what's going on and why, because then the lies don't drive me crazy and I can live my own life. I can live free. You're very free. You know, your mind is free. And so, I think there's only one way to navigate this thing, and that's to look it square in the face and deal with the uncertainty and laugh about it. Do you know what I mean? We don't have to go along.
We completely agree. I agree 100% with you. I don't necessarily think that what I'm doing in my life is going to transform the world, other than transform a number of people who may be listening and get into the research it has with you. But I do it because what's the alternative? I have to be free. I have to be free in my mind, and I want to be able to pursue my research. And the alternative is what? Watching Monday Night Football or Dancing with the Stars? You know, I can't do that. I'm not able, in my DNA, I'm not able to do that. So I have to do what I'm doing. I believe in what I do, just as you do.
Yeah.
And I have to think that if enough of us get together and we work and we put our heads together and collaborate, that we can contribute to making the world a better place. I have to believe that, and I do believe that.
Oh, I'm highly, I don't think this is a fait accompli at all, because I've lived inside of empire, and what I have to tell you is, you know the story about when they asked me to join the Council on Foreign Relations, and when I said, you know, it was a wonderful guy who asked me, pushed this glossy brochure towards me, and when I said, you know, I just can't, and he looked terrified. He said, you don't understand. You'll be out forever. And just at that moment, I had a flash of them taking my name off my underground locker. And I thought, you know, I'd rather die on the surface. I'd rather die on the surface with the hoi polloi.
So, wait, you don't understand. You'll be out forever?
You'll be out forever. And literally, what I saw in my mind was my name coming off my underground locker. But here was the thing. The thought of getting stuck underground with all of those folks was more horrifying to me than whatever was going to face me in the wilderness.
See, this is giving you a threat. Like, you'll be out forever. No.
This was a wonderful man who I liked and admired very much. He was afraid for me, because he understood that if I was out, you know, what that meant. Now, you know, I didn't have, that I know of, I didn't have an underground locker and, you know, you know, you just always presumed.
Like if when it hits the fan, that.
When the hit, you know, if you're one of the members of the council and you're in certain groups, when the whatever hits the fan, you'll be taken care of was the wink, wink assumption. I don't know. He was just very, he was sincerely terrified for me.
You went through your enemy of the state saga.
Well, you know, it's really funny because all my life, what I wanted to do was get out, and I didn't understand the only way out was to get thrown out. Anyway, but let's talk about how people can get more information. There's first, I want to really recommend your new book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, which I refer to as the definitive introduction and overview of the whole topic. And then there's Richard's book, Hidden in Plain Sight, which you published. You also have a lecture on underground facilities that's up on YouTube that can watch. I'm hoping I can persuade you to give us the picture so we can use it on the video, so they can see the pictures. Okay. And then there's the Secret Space Program presentations that are available to subscribers for free. What else? Introduce us to your website one more time and tell us how we can follow you.
My website is richarddolanpress.com. It features my work. I have four books that I've published. Introductions of all of the books are just readily available. You can read them. About 50, 60 various articles I've written are also on that website, articles I've written over the years. Authors that I now publish, I'm very proud. I've developed a nice stable of excellent forward-thinking authors who have unique contributions to the study of
you know, behind-the-scenes machinations, UFOs. So it's Richard Stouter's work. It's I have a book by Dr. Bruce McAbee, a very respected researcher of the UFO phenomenon, who writes about the FBI, CIA, and UFO connection, probably the finest book of its kind that's ever been done. And books that I've done by other, I think, very respected, sober researchers who've got genuine contributions to make in the field. So all of that's at richardolinpress.com. People can go there and look at it. I have a lot of videos that I've done. There are new ones that being put up all the time. I literally can't keep track of them. If you go to YouTube and type in Richard Dolan, you'll find a lot of new ones. I'm currently working on I evolve my presentations each year, and some of the things that you and I talked about today are some of the key themes that I'm hitting. So in other words, the necessity of constant false flags. I'm really looking a lot at false flags, Catherine, and in fact, this might be the subject of a major piece of writing that I do in the near future. But I'm trying to understand the geopolitics of the UFO phenomenon, implications for the end of secrecy that is for disclosure. And I'm trying to make as many steps as I can to understand this big picture. And I have a feeling some of those lectures will be, I've given one or two of them lately. They'll probably appear on YouTube before long. But anyway, the foundation is richardolinpress.com, and that's where people can probably learn.
Okay, and I just have to mention, I'm very excited. We're going to be doing, it's a little bit extended to a lunch. We're going to be doing 10 to 3 on April 25th in New York. Venue, we're still nailing down the venue with Richard Dolan, and it'll be invitation to subscribers only. And so if you're interested, send an email to customerservice@solari.com if you want an invitation. That's going to be a chance to really say, okay, Richard, what do you really think about this? So that'll be fun because it'll be a small group. Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun.
Looking forward to it. Well, Solari subscribers are, let's face it, they're very, very, I don't want to say a cut above, but really they're a cut above the rest. They're knowledgeable, intelligent, and it would be a real pleasure for me to just spend the afternoon with you and the Solari people.
We spent a bunch of time with subscribers finding out what they find useful, and here's what one of them said. He said, on the internet you can find two sort of ways of being. One is bread and circus, and the other is gloom and doom. And he said, you're the only one that likes to look at what is really going on, but then translate it into, you know, okay, how do we live free and inspired? So it's bread and circus, gloom and doom, and free and inspired. So we're trying to be the free and inspired one.
I appreciate that. Yeah, that's right. I mean, who wants to be, first of all, I don't approach any of the subjects that we've discussed from an emotional perspective. I really want to understand what is the truth. I have ideals. I believe in them just as you do. I believe in freedom. I believe in human dignity. And I guess I want to be a problem solver.
Right.
But you can't run away from the problem. You can't pretend there are no problems. They're significant. But there has to be a way for us to deal with them.
Right. I would describe Solari subscribers as problem solvers. They're people who like to, you know, they like to kind of sneak around. They're quiet about it. They sneak around and get things done. Anyway, okay, well, Richard, it's been a lovely conversation. Thank you again. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.
Have a great day.